and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. Not Kurosawa, Spike Lee. And the second half of the 1991 pairing. First we did Jungle Fever. And now we're covering the Oscar winner for Best Picture winner for 1991, Silence of the Lambs. And with me is he's a bit of a creep. He's his salad right next to Hannibal Lecter's. It's Migs.
Oh, I'm Joel. I'm so glad you made me Migs. yeah, because I can't do a Hannibal Lecter impersonation, but I can do a Migs. Wait, never mind. I'm not going to continue that sentence.
Yeah. So, and joining us is, I guess, there's a crossover episode with, Let's Get Weirding. There's another one with a similar name. I hope I got it right. Megan
you
and
you got it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Megan and Bo, both returning guests.
Hello.
Hey. So,
thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're welcome.
So glad to have you.
What made you guys want to pick Silence of the Lambs over Barton Fink?
I mean, I love both movies. Mm-hmm. I've seen Silence of the Lambs more times than I can count, though, and I've got a bit... I know I'm going to speak for Megan, too. Sorry, Megan. Mm. But I can speak for both of us. We both kind of have an obsession with these books. We've both read all of the books quite a few times and seen all of the movies, so we would consider ourselves armchair experts in the Hannibal verse. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. Yeah, definitely.
And I'm glad I have some super fans on here because, like, it's going to get this out of the way. Like, this movie is kind of a masterpiece, and I don't know, like, what to say about it that has not been said.
Yeah, that is always the problem with something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I saw once in high school, and it just never left. Like, it was just like, that movie's fucking amazing. And coming back to it, it's just like, it's even better than I remembered. Except for some of the LGBT stuff that kind of aged weirdly. But besides that, like, it's...
Yeah, the source material doesn't is never, like, Thomas Harris has never really been the best with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of writing LGBT characters or disabled characters. Not always the most sensitive portrayals, I'll just say.
We could say that.
Yeah, but outside of that, like, everything is like, this is... Like, the Oscars just announced their lineup. I don't know what you call it. Nominees, there you go. But, like, this is, like, a year, like, yeah, this is kind of the right choice of, like, for Best Picture. It's
really... Yeah, mm-hmm. It's no Green Book, that's for sure.
No. Oh.
Yeah. So, Joel, do you like this movie as well?
It's okay. No, I'm just kidding. It's in my top 10. Like, of all-time movies. Every time I rewatch it, I feel like I'm getting a little bit more out of like, not, you know, the story is... What am I trying to say? The film keeps having these layers that I didn't see, and these little touches, and these, you know, parts of the dialogue, and, like, music cues, the way the camera is used in... the crime scene scenes as opposed to the interview scenes. And I think my favorite thing that I've been getting out of the movie, especially with the last watching, was how good Clarice Starling is a character. And I guess it's okay.
So what were your guys' first time seeing the movie? Because I was born in 91, so of course I didn't see it.
I'm pretty sure I saw this when it came out on VHS, like, you know, after it was in theaters, so not long after it was released. Because I was too... I don't think that I was old enough yet to see it in the theater. Not that my parents have ever been shy about taking me to R-rated movies. I've seen many of them way before I should have. But, yeah, I saw this... for some reason, my mom loves this movie, and I don't mean it like, for some reason my mom loves this movie. My mom hates anything scary or, you know, bloody, but she loves this movie and has seen it so many times. And it's just one of those that, one of those rare things that we both actually like. So it's just a really well-made film.
Mm-hmm. I probably first saw it, at some point when it would have been on, like, HBO, I think I finally sat down to watch it. I did not see it when it first came out. I actually read the book first. I did a book report on this book in, like, the seventh grade.
Yeah.
And just to compare mom anecdotes, I think to this day that book report remains the most my mom knows about this book and this movie. because that is not her speed. And... yeah, it's just, honestly, it sounds very cheesy, but so I rewatched it for just to be you know, fresh for this, and just already just talking about it, I'm like, ooh, I could watch that again tonight. Mm-hmm. Like, ooh, I could just put that on.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter how many times I've seen it, like, when that opening score starts mm-hmm. up, like, I feel like, you know, like I get a chill up my arms, like, it's just good shit.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of those great adaptations that just knew exactly what stuff to leave in the world of a book.
Yes.
Like Hannibal Lecter's red eyes.
Yes.
And his polydactyly. They went, maybe we don't.
Yeah.
Let's just leave that
one. Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan Demme.
Yeah.
Thank you.
He has, like, blood red eyes in the book?
Yeah, they're maroon.
He has red eyes, yeah. Yes.
And he has an extra finger on both of his hands.
Yep.
Interesting.
The better to touch you with, my dear. No,
which then, Thomas in Harris Hannibal, the novel, they specifically mention how he had them removed because they're like, yeah, look for the scars when he's on the hunt. Because they're just like, oh, shit. Like, Thomas Harris, I think, even was like, let's just... we had to take it
Thomas
off.
Harris is incredibly hokey, is the thing. It's like, he created these great characters, like Hannibal Lecter, Will Graham, Clarice Starling, like... Jack Crawford. He made all of these really great characters, but it's sort of like that Stephen King thing, you know, where mm-hmm. like he's written so many like really good books, but he's so fucking corny.
Or there's
sometimes
always
it's a little hard to stomach.
This one, there's always like that one weird, like in Red Dragon when the lady's just feeling up the tiger.
Yeah.
It's like, why is that happening?
But it's really great on screen. I
is
stand
it?
By that. Yes.
Her petting the tiger. Man,
in Manhunter, I love that scene. Yeah.
Her touching the tiger is great.
So close to a killer, right? Come on. Yeah. Right.
That see, going to see, like, touch the tiger is the good part. I meant the specific description of her, like, grabbing its balls.
Cupping its balls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's blind.
That's wonderful. Yeah. She didn't know she was grabbing some balls.
Oh, she did. Dollar Hyde, like, becomes turgid watching it. I've read that book a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie, I guess the source material too, like, the movie definitely feels like it owes a lot to Psycho, down to there's a very oblique reference. I'm not sure I use the word oblique, right? But there's a very dark reference to Psycho when Clarice is exploring the like the old like storage space, and you see like the owl. The stuffed mm-hmm. owl, and it's like, oh, it's just like Psycho, and then all these references to birds, like Psycho is full of references to birds all over the place, and this has,
yeah,
Starling is a bird, yeah. They talk about tern, like a tern's nest on a beach, and there's a couple other things where it's like, he's clearly nodding to, Hitchcock, just a little bit throughout.
Yeah, he doesn't go as buck wild with it as like Brian Fuller did in the NBC show, like, because there are so many so many like little winks and nods to the source material in that, and like so many influences in that show. I mean, I'm not here to talk about Hannibal. I could be here all day, but he does go like overboard with a lot of references on that show.
So I feel like the movie's famous enough that we don't have to really talk about like the plot in that much detail. So like I guess we should.
I think we should say yeah. it's about a lady with a moth for a mouth. Okay. And kind of brownish reddish. No, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the poster. No, you're right. I mean, it's about. Rookie, not quite FBI agent yet, right? She's still in training. Gets roped in gets roped in to interview a famous killer that you no doubt heard about in the first book. I mean, wait, came out afterwards. It doesn't matter. I mean, Hannibal's stealing the show that way. What else?
Yeah, but like, I want to
there's another.
Get out
there's
of-
another killer, and everyone happy ending.
Yeah, the killer is the monk's boss.
Yeah, it really is not a happy ending, though.
Oh yeah,
it puts the lotion on his skin.
Yeah,
does an amazing dance.
Yeah, what's sad is that I realized like some time ago that I have the same musical taste as the serial killer.
Goodbye Horses is a fantastic song.
It's so good. But like there's like another song he was listening to. Yeah. And I was like, oh yeah, this slaps. Just like, guy, what's wrong with you?
I really am, as I mentioned to you earlier today, Bo, I'm a little disappointed that that's the scalp he chose.
I
to
know.
Keep that hair. Like,
you
really?
Know, wigs are not that hard. Like,
yeah, you can find just a wig. My dude,
just
you don't have
befriend,
to yeah.
befriend a drag queen, for fuck's sake. they will hook you up.
He's in the backwoods of Ohio. I'm not sure there are that many drag queens out there.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I guess he's a hipster and wants the organic hair, not the fake hair.
Right from the source.
But, do you guys want to, like, knock out the thing that people have a problem with now, the trans representation and that angle of this first, just to get like the ugly stuff out of the way.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I think is the biggest problem with that, obviously, is that there is mention in the story and in the book that you know, James Gunn is not actually transgender. He just doesn't know, like, he's so outside of himself, like, he can't see himself. You know, I don't know if that's, you know, sociopathic or psycho, you know, but that doesn't, it's not emphasized enough.
Yeah.
And that's something that, having watched the movie a lot, having read the book a lot, that I know that part because I've read it and I've heard it, but they really do not go out of their way to reemphasize the fact that this is not actually, you know, a trans individual. This is, you know, so instead we get what comes across as, you know, oh, look, that this person is mentally ill and it's because, you know, he thinks he's a woman. And it's like, no, oh God, no.
Outside of that scene that they're talking about, there's almost no mention of the fact that this is what he's doing, you know, taking girls' skins in order to wear it, and whatever his intention is, it's like because we're spending any time at Buffalo Bill, we have this inside knowledge of his sickness. So it's like I sometimes I feel because I'm not a trans person. At first it was like, well, I don't necessarily know, but now, like, yeah, I what I'm trying to say is I guess I'm not at liberty to express my opinions. That's how I feel about it, because it doesn't affect me.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not the ones that are really affected by this. Like, exactly. A trans person watching this would probably be horrified at this at these descriptions of being transgendered, and that's just does not reflect the character at all, really. Like, that's not what's actually going on here. And Megan's totally, you nailed it. Like, they really don't emphasize that well enough, that he is someone that is, it's a, I don't want to say an identity crisis, because that just boils it down a little too simply, but
in
the book, they also tie in classic, mom issues and that kind of,
because we didn't have that with Frances Dolarhyde already.
That part of the movie just kind of really ages it, and it's the 90s, all right. I mean, it's better than an 80s comedy, but still, not the best. It's definitely an improvement from what the 80s did, with even mentioning stuff like this.
And I might be forgetting, but at the very least, there's never. Everyone is appropriately horrified at what he is doing, and not necessarily that aspect. Mm-hmm. No one is no one is saying is this a trans individual? There's never that kind of conversation. It's just, well, why is he killing people? Let's discuss that.
Yeah.
Which again, still doesn't make any of it all right, but like you're saying, it's not like an Ace Ventura situation where now everyone's, being ill because it's a disgusting 90s comedy.
Yeah,
there's a surprising lack of record scratches in this movie.
There should have been one when Meg showed up.
They should all have that glass in front of their cells.
Yeah, I forgot about the Migs moment, and I was like, oh, that's kind of a little too gross for a movie.
Pretty graphic.
It's very graphic, okay, yeah.
When I first saw the movie, which I didn't see until I was in my 20s, because I was under the assumption that I wouldn't like horror movies until I saw my first horror movie way after high school, and I was
Joel, this is a thriller, because it won an Oscar.
Oh, that's true, I'm sorry.
It's not a horror movie, it's a thriller.
Yeah. It's a comedy or musical. So I think that I must have assumed it was urine or not really understood what was going on the scene. But once you realize what it was, you just, I mean, that's so revolting.
Oh, yeah. And it's, there it is. Like, oh, look, we just, great.
Yeah, it gets in your hair. That's just a day ruiner.
And that's the inciting
incident.
Even
if it's from someone that you like.
It's setting the rest of the film up to what Clarice is going to have to be dealing with. Mm-hmm. It's like, you put her in almost the extreme end there, and then from everything else, any other misogyny just, feels almost normal.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of shots of her, Joy Foster. Like, I looked up how tall she was, because she just looks so tiny next to so many of the men in the movie. She's 5'2", which is not close to average height for a woman, but it's still on the shorter side. But it's she just looks like a child in some scenes, like the one in West Virginia where she's in the room with the corpse and all the cops. Like, she's just like a little kid almost. And so it's just brilliant how Demi framed her to look so out of the ordinary compared to this world of men.
So diminutive, yes.
And she's got to get her country out.
Yep. She busted out those y'all go on nows.
Yeah. Thank you very much. You did all you can. Get on now.
Y'all get on now. So good.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the scenes of her in the elevator at Quantico.
Yeah.
She's just in a little sweatshirt. I'm going to a meeting.
She's, Now I know she's 5'2". Those guys must have been like 7 feet tall. I don't know.
They were standing on boxes.
They're like 2. Yeah, like 3 feet taller than her. Be like, well, how's the weather down there? I'm like, okay, guys, come on.
We're gonna need half a dozen phone books.
Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, putting everyone. They're like, we need the call is for anyone 6'5" and up.
I also noticed that Casey Lemons is in this, and both of your episodes, Casey Lemons had a part in.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Although here she's not used as much as in Candyman, which is a little disappointing.
I mean, at least she's in the movie because she's completely written out of the second movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her character is completely... Yeah. And I don't think she would have been in it either way, because that was, movie was dog shit, but...
Also, like, that was after
Opinions.
Also, after his body, she kind of quit acting, it looked like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love their friendship so much in this movie, and I do wish that there was a little more of it, although it doesn't have a place, unfortunately. There's more scenes of them in the book, because mm-hmm. it's a book, but, you know, it's not like, they didn't have cell phones, so it's not like Clarice could be like, let me give her a call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is she black in the book, too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so how close is it to the book?
Pretty close. A lot of...
Yeah.
Dialogue is pretty verbatim. Some of the stuff that they have trimmed down, like there's a whole section where Lecter gives them like the fake name that he gives them is actually a shit joke.
Mm-hmm. Chilton.
For Chilton.
Yeah.
And
they left out some stuff about her family, like yeah. her mom and stuff. Like, her mom was very much part of her upbringing. And it, you know, that all kind of got written out of
yeah,
the movie.
Yeah, because I think it's easier in a, you know, if she's just telling her story to have it be, oh, my mom had died, my dad died, I had to go live with these relatives. I believe in the book, mm-hmm. it's that her mom just, like, couldn't afford
yeah.
to keep her.
Her mom
I think
was,
she
like,
had
a hotel
siblings.
Maid. Yeah.
And I think she had siblings too, so it was just like her mom had to send her away because she couldn't afford to have all of her kids there anymore. Yeah, and other than that, it's just a lot of scenes are longer. You get more, there's a lot more Gum backstory.
Yeah. And I feel like there's quite a bit more Jack Crawford in the book as well, so.
Well, because you find out about his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the stuff about his wife, because his wife is dying.
Yeah, his wife has cancer.
Yeah. Mm. So there's a lot more of that, and just a lot more thought processes. Like, even just in the very beginning, when Starling goes to see him, she's surprised that he even remembers her, because when she joined the Academy, she wrote him a note, and he didn't answer, so she was just kind of like, all right, you son of a bitch. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot, and there are many more references to how absolutely gorgeous Starling is.
Yeah.
She's so pretty. Oh,
she's so beautiful.
No one can believe that she's as smart and capable as she is, because she's just so dang pretty.
I mean, oh, why do you have to be smart? You're so pretty.
And there's a part when she goes to visit Chilton the first time where he's just like, oh, the FBI is going to the girls.
Yeah.
Like, oh!
Oh, yeah.
He's so Chilton awful in the movie, but he's worse.
That's
in the
where
book.
Record scratch was.
Yeah.
There's also some, she's like, when she's investigating Catherine Martin's disappearance, like, she actually, in the book, goes to Catherine's apartment and, like, kind of goes through her stuff, finds her
Does
LSD stash.
Yeah, all of her LSD and her, like, she has dirty pictures as well.
Yeah.
But they're, like, actually dirty, I think.
Yeah. Not like poor Frederica.
Oh,
sad,
Frederica.
Sad granny panty. Sexy pictures. Oh.
Yeah, and then, you know, the genesis of 100,000 size 14 jokes.
Yeah, love those.
Always hilarious.
Keep them up. Keep them coming, guys. We sure love hearing them.
Never would have occurred to us. Yeah. Also, in the book, the part that I have always considered to be the creepiest part is that there is a moment in the book when we are getting Gum's point of view where he's thinking about how great his life is going to be once he has made this woman suit, and that he knows of places that he can go, and I believe he says yachts that he can go on, where it's going to be really appreciated and people are going to admire his work. And I'm just like, who the fuck are those people?
Yeah.
Ew. Like, what is this cabal of just, like, oh. Like, that's, and it's just this throwaway, like, thing where it's just, he's working alone, but he has this, like, I don't know, he's been on the very early dark web, and, like, oh, God. Like, yeah, all this stuff is awful, but what was that part? Go back to that.
I mean, that's like Hannibal's, like, Rolodex of other killers that he's in. Maybe that's how he knows anything. Although there's no indication that they were ever in contact. Well, he was a former patient. Is that what was going on?
He was involved with a former patient.
I see.
There's something, like, when I was rewatching it, my husband was asking me about when she's looking in the storage unit. And I feel like there is some aspect that they've changed slightly with that story to the movie. Because as I was explaining it to my husband, I realized that it wasn't matching up with what the movie was saying. And I was like, okay, it must be from the book then. But I, of course, can't, like, find it at the moment. And I can't think of it. But I think it's because, yeah, it's like something like, he knew of this person through this other person because, like, at one point, James Gum had made, like, a really awful apron out of someone's flesh or something. There's some scene where someone had told Lecter about, like, oh, I came home, and he was like, oh, I made this apron. Like, and then he put it all together because, you know, he's brilliant.
He's just the most brilliant.
Well, you know. Nazis eat his sister, Bo.
It happens.
That's apocryphal, isn't it?
No, it's in Hannibal.
Oh, right, right.
It's not in Hannibal Rising.
Yeah. It's been a while since I read it. I always get those two mixed up. I always wonder, I thought that they made that part up for that last book, but I stand corrected.
No, it's in Hannibal. Because that
that's right, because her name is Misha. Yes, I remember. I remember all that. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that leads, yeah. I won't go into where that leads.
Please don't.
That's neither here nor there.
It really, and this is what this is the curse, though, of having read all these books, is that knowing the trajectory, and I said this to Megan earlier, like, knowing the trajectory that Clarice's, both her career and her life, takes after this story ends is horribly depressing. And it's just like, you end on this sort of like, oh, look at her, she caught this famous serial killer, and, you know, she's gonna have this meteoric career, and it's just not the case at all. Because, like, as you were saying, like, she is this small woman in this man's world, and it seems like from this point on they do everything they can to kind of keep her down.
Yeah, absolutely, that's exactly what happens. And
yeah,
everything she does gets, you know, misconstrued or thrown up in the tabloids, and
yeah,
they find out about her talking with Lecter, and so there's a lot of, you know, they mentioned some of that in the book, I believe. That isn't in the movie. There's I think Chilton leaks, like, a picture of her talking to Lecter, and so it's on the tabloids, all like, you know, Lecter's girlfriend, like, the FBI got him a honey kind of thing. And so, yeah, if you just want to look at the movie, like, as we are, then you can just be like, yeah, she got the killer. Lecter's not going to come after her because he's, you know, in the Caribbean in a wig. And, you know, it's going to be fine. But yeah, then if you, I mean, see the next movie, which don't, or read the next book. It's not what happens, but... No. Yeah, and the ending of Hannibal the movie is different than Hannibal the novel.
Yeah, vastly different.
They changed it because Jodie Foster wouldn't be in that movie with the original ending, and then they changed it and she was still like, yeah, nah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that original ending. Woo, buddy.
Okay.
So, I just, you know how I feel about it. I hate it. I hate it so much.
But the ending of this movie is great.
Yes, very good.
Darling brings her two bug scientist boyfriends to
Yep. One of whom isn't that Bulldog from Frasier? Yeah.
It very much is, yeah.
When I was watching it today, I was like, I think that's Bulldog. I'm not going to look
at Everyone is in this movie. Chris Isaac's in this movie. Roger Corman is in this movie.
He is.
George Romero is in the movie. And that's someone they... Yeah, he's like an FBI agent in Tennessee. That's someone they should have put her next to because he was a very tall man.
Yeah.
I met him once and he's very tall. So... Yeah, like, this movie is just, like, the cameos are kind of hysterical because it's like, is that Chris Isaac?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Charles Napier shows up, and he's, I love Russ Meyer movies, and Russ Meyer loved to put him in stuff, and seeing him in a, like, a quote-unquote legitimate movie was kind of jarring a little bit. But, like, he looks the same, like, since the 70s, just, like, that big square jaw. Like, rough-looking face, blonde hair.
And I think...
Sorry, Megan, go ahead.
I was trying to think of, like, all the characters, and I'm just like, who is actually also, like, a good character in this? Like, as a good, quote-unquote, good person. And I was like, I guess, like, Clarice and Ardelia, and Kyna Crawford and Barney.
Barney. Oh, yeah. Frankie Faison.
Yes. Like,
this was the first thing I ever saw him in.
Mm-hmm. Oh. The first thing I ever saw him in was Cat People, which is...
Oh, you know, I think maybe... I can't remember which one of those I saw first.
I was too young to be watching Cat People, believe you me.
Yeah, isn't Frankie Faison in every Hannibal Lecter movie? Because he's a manhunter.
But he's not playing Barney.
No.
Yeah, because they didn't even have that part yet. Or, like, Lecter wasn't in the same facility, I don't think, in that one.
Yeah, because...
There was no Chilton in that one.
No. Yeah, because Red Dragon came out before Silence of the Lambs, obviously. And then, so Manhunter, yeah, the other Lecter.
Yeah, Brian Cox. Brian Cox. Yeah.
Yeah, and he is, like, what, 5 minutes in that movie? Maybe even less than that.
It's a very blink and you miss it kind of thing, yeah.
Which is, and that's sort of the problem, I think, with then these other movies. And then when they did Red Dragon, is that, yeah, Hannibal Lecter is not really in that book. If you gather all of his pages together, you get about a 5-minute cameo. And of course they had to up it because it's like, oh my gosh, you know, Sir Anthony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter, here he comes again. And it's like, but that's not... how it operates. And then the ending of that movie when they're like, oh, here comes Clarice Starling, it's like, that's not, the timeline is wrong.
Yeah, like, way wrong.
Do not talk to me about the timeline.
Like, it kind of like for me, I heard this movie for a long time before I actually saw it, and so, like, Hannibal Lecter was basically like Freddy Krueger to me in certain ways. And, like, I guess, like, kids...
They had Halloween masks and everything else of him, like, rubber masks, like they do. So, yeah, they were... I mean, he was marketed like that after this.
Oh, okay. But, like, seeing this movie is like, oh, he actually is, like, a terrifying character. Like, it's just, like... I don't know, like, it's just, like, amazing how he kind of turned to his pop culture figure. When it's like, this guy? I don't... Why? I don't understand.
And, I mean, and it's one of those things where when you come to the context, like, one of my coworkers, who is a very dear, very sweet, very religious woman, does the "Hello, Clarice" all the time. And every time she does it, I want to be like, have you ever even seen that movie? Because that is not a movie you would watch. Like, I could see her have seeing that clip, like, in a trailer and be like, ooh, like, that movie's not for me. But she does that line. And, I mean, people do, you know, the fava beans line. And it's like, you know he's talking about killing and eating a person, right? Like, yeah. I know he does the funny tongue thing, but he was talking about killing and eating a person.
I just... Like, Hannibal is pretty scary in this movie. Like, even still, like, just watching it this morning, I was like, yeah, I mean, this is a totally creepy performance. And I think because it has these, like, eccentric beats to it, like, mm-hmm. the line, like, best thing for him really is therapy was going nowhere. It's like, oh, okay, that's, like, funny and also incredibly creepy. But, like, after this movie, I feel like Hopkins just took the character in a very, like, hammy direction.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So much ham after this. But this, in this movie, this is a great performance from Hopkins. Like,
absolutely.
A plus, yeah.
And, like, when you say hammy.
This might be a dumb question, but is he supposed to be European, Hannibal Lecter?
Yes, he's from Lithuania.
The book he was born in Lithuania, but has lived in the States for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, I guess if you're going to consider Hannibal Rising canon, if he lives in France for a long time with his uncle and his aunt. Mm-hmm. His aunt was Japanese, and so that's why, like, there was a little... In the show, they had a lot of, like, a whole season that had kind of a Japanese influence.
Yeah, season two was a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what you were saying about it being hammy, you see that in some of the lines in this movie, but they're done so well that they're creepy. Like the one I mentioned to you earlier that I love, the, you know, love your suit.
Yeah, love your suit.
In the later movies, if he were to say that same kind of line, it would be so, like, bitchy.
Mm.
You know, and it's, here it's cruel. It is. It's him, you know, it's like him, the questioning about, you know, the breastfeeding. It's also just him being like, you know, here's another nasty thing I can say to you because I actually really don't have human emotions because I kill and eat people.
Yeah, there are a couple lines from, like, that you said that I thought were a little silly. One was, big third hips, roomy. I guess that's a little silly from him.
Yeah, this whole performance seems kind of ham salad to me, but I know what you're talking about. In Hannibal, he's in on the joke like Freddy Krueger in the later movies.
Yeah,
but I'm sorry. I know. Obviously, Megan does not like Hannibal. Hates possibly. I do like that movie. I just don't like it nearly as much as I like Silence of the Lambs.
I think. Well, to be fair to it. I had to come around on the book because I got the book when it first came out. And I was very excited. It was like a big, like, you know, back in the day, kids, you bought books. Like, your mom had to go to Barnes & Noble at Christmas and buy you a new book. And then I read it and I was like, this book is awful. Yep. And then I tried it again a couple years later and I was able to see more of what Harris was going for, which was this very, like, grandiose, like, oh, I'm going to make this as kind of like weird gothic grand, you know, woo fiction. And it was like, all right, I can accept this now. And it's not as good as the other ones. Red Dragon is a terrifying book.
It is.
Silence of the Lambs, not quite as scary. Like, Red Dragon kept me up at night. But the movie Hannibal, so my roommate and I in college both loved Silence of the Lambs. And we were very excited to go see this to the point that we went to the theater, like, opening night to see Hannibal. We dressed up. And then it was like, oh, this isn't very good. And I just really haven't revisited it. And I begrudgingly saw Red Dragon.
I'm sorry I hurt you.
And
is what I'd like to say on behalf of Hannibal.
So maybe I'll give it another shot at some point, but it's not the high book? On the list.
Because the movie is...
No, the movie, because I've read the book several times again since then. Wait,
did we already talk about how everybody feels about Manhunter?
Masterpiece. It's great. Flawless. I love it. Yeah.
It's so good.
Plus, Chris Elliott is in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
He always surprised me every time I watch it.
Oh, yeah. He's got that part where he goes on stage and an old woman beds a quarter. Oh, wait.
But I should say, because I'm not sure if she listened to it, but former guest Alexandra Daniels loves Manhunter and Red Dragon equally.
Hmm.
So,
interesting.
Yeah. Wait, you didn't tell me it was crazy.
But she's going to come on pretty soon, so maybe we can, if I remember, I can ask her to clarify some of that.
Yeah. That's...
Well, like, Ralph Fiennes is great in Red Dragon.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I feel he's in a different movie at times than the Lecter parts.
I was going to say, like, the Lecter parts are really what is so not good in Red Dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No hate for Anthony Hopkins. Love him. Amazing actor. He's living his life on Twitter.
Yeah. I loved him in Westworld.
He's a Pope now. I didn't watch that movie. I just know he's in that movie.
In what?
What's that?
Two Popes.
The Two Popes.
Oh.
He's in that with Jonathan Pryce. He's a Pope in that.
Oh.
I felt like that was one I could skip.
I got that really confused with the new pope, and I was like, why are there so many popes?
There's a young pope, a new pope, there's two popes. We got popes coming out of our ears over here.
Mm-hmm. And I thought people only thought that we had two popes if they were, like, conspiracy theorists on Twitter.
We can't help it. The nation has... Pope fever is sweeping the nation.
Oh, it's like in the 90s when everything was angels.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now it's just popes.
Have my pope.
No one tell Jack Chick. Man, yeah, my only notes for this episode were this movie is great.
In conclusion,
this movie
I do
rules.
Actually have to wonder, though, if Ted Levine has, like, does this performance follow him around?
Has it followed him
around through his career?
I read a random roles with him, and he talked about that, and I think, to an extent it was. Because I think he just wasn't expecting it to be what it was, like, as big as it was.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know if he...
I feel like, age demographic, like, older people probably now are like, oh, I saw you on Monk for years, you know?
And, Yeah.
Although there is that one lady who was like... Hannibal. No.
That'd be me. If I was in line at, like, Starbucks and I heard someone behind me and I realized it was Ted Levine, I'd probably be like,
You wouldn't be like, hey, Wild Wild West, high five.
I always forget he was in that, even
though
I've seen
that
movie like four times.
Oh, no. Mary,
right now, Mary's going, well, she was going through Monk, and every time he'd come on screen, I'd be like, was she a big fat person? Which got kind of annoying pretty quickly.
Monk had to solve him.
That man had to put up with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So much. Imagine having to be Monk's boss.
I mean, like, it gets because sure, like, it's a great performance, but unfortunately, it kind of. You know, like, this, like, it's a curse.
It's hard to see him as anything else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah,
he's the dad in the Health of Eyes remake, but
you know, that's right.
Whatever.
He's kind of a hero in that. There are no heroes in that.
No.
I hate the Hills Have Eyes.
The remake
is that against horror law? Both, honestly.
Interesting.
I don't think that's necessarily an unpopular. It's for some people and it's not for others. Like me, I also don't like that movie.
I have
interesting.
There's that period of, like, the 70s horror where everything was very gritty, and it's just, at the end of the day, who wins? No one. Like, we're all dead, all the women have been sexually assaulted, and, I don't know, maybe, it's not, there's not even the joy of, like, a final girl, it's just like, I don't know, everyone's dead. It's like Last House on the Left, it's just like, I don't know.
Yeah, the last page just says, everyone's dead. Okay.
Like, oh, good.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, that's my favorite Wes Craven movie. But,
oh, wow.
But I understand why people...
Wait. Aren't you a big Music of the Heart fan?
Yeah, I'm a big Swamp Thing fan. not because of that scene, because I legit like the movie.
No, Swamp Thing's great. Oh, yeah. That, especially the kid who's at the store. Like, you got a gun in this place? What kind of question is that? Of course we have a gun.
But back to Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
Like, I love, like, it's just, like, such classic Hollywood filmmaking, like, at its best. Like, this is, like, like, what a ideal, like, big studio picture should be, because it's, like, it has enough, like, grit and kind of, like, stuff going on, where it's, like, it's a prestige movie, but it's also that big old crowd pleaser, and it rides that balance so incredibly well in a way. It's, like, why can't more movies do this? But then you watch Silence of the Lambs, and, like, oh, because it's kind of hard to find that balance between how
Because,
like, I love how every place and thing in this movie looks like it's very real and it's very grounded in the real world. Like, none of it is, like, glossy and new and pretty. Like, it's all just very kind of dingy. Like, and like when scenes when Clarice is inside people's homes and it's like, yeah, that looks like a real person, like, lives there. It doesn't look like a set. You know what I mean? Like, nothing in this movie feels like a set. It feels very, like, very much part of the real world, which is what I love about it.
And, like, Frederica, when she goes to her house, that is such a specific kind, like, her room is such a specific kind of, you know, small town, you know, and well, like, even, like, when she, you know, when they're looking at her, it's just like, oh, you know, when they look at the body and it's like, oh, the nail polish, where she's like, it's too fancy for around here. And it's like, that's not particularly fancy to have just bought a bottle of nail polish, but you get where she's coming from. And if you know small towns, you're like, yeah, no, I get it. And even, you know, when she's interviewing Stacy, Frederica's friend, and, you know, she's just like, oh, do you have to go to college to be in the FBI? Because it seems like a cool job. And it's like, this seems like a cool job to you. She's asking you about your murdered friend. But anything to get out of this town, probably.
Yeah, I mean, if they were to make this movie, remake it today, like, that character would probably be played by, like, I don't know, like, Samara Weaving or someone, like, drop dead gorgeous, because we can't have a real person in a movie.
And that's the other thing, is that everyone is so real. Like, Jodie Foster is beautiful, but she's realistically beautiful. Like, when she walks into rooms, people, you could tell that it's supposed to be, like, you know, Chilton's a creep, but he's just like, oh, hello. It's like, well, yeah, because, like, especially if 1991 Jodie Foster walked in the room, you'd be like, well, hello. But it's not, like, some movie stars where you'd just be like, wait, is that, are you a real person?
Is this happening right now? Do you have a pore?
Like, if it was Michelle Pfeiffer or someone, this would be, like, a different movie altogether. But, like, but, like, going on to Chilton thread, I like how that relationship develops, because it goes from, like, he's kind of bossing her around and, like, in complete control, and then I think the third time she's there, she's bossing him around, and he's, like, acting, and he's acting like, what are you doing? This is my job. And she's like, so what?
Ugh, for me, the creepiest part is always when he just is that snotty, like, you could have told me that in my office.
And saved me the trip.
Saved me the trip. It's like, oh, shut up. Oh, you're such a creep.
Chilton is such a creep.
Yeah. And he's a very specific kind of creep that I kind of have to give Thomas Harris props for writing, because I feel like, I'll be fair, like, a lot of male authors, I don't think would have written a creep quite that good. I feel like he definitely asked some women. Like, have you ever met a really just slimy creep when you were at work? They're like, oh, yes, please, let me give you some traits.
That would be fascinating if Chilton is just a distillation of everyone's horrible boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and he's, like, the first of several men who, like, once they meet her, is like, hey, we want to go out sometime? Which happens...
Yes!
Like maybe three or four times? But it's enough where
I believe...
It's like, Jesus Christ, she's an FBI agent solving a murder. Give her some space.
And I only kind
of... In 1991, are you kidding? Give a woman space.
Yeah. I only kind of buy it when she does go to the museum with the larva, because they're in this like weird scenario where they're all just opening up this cocoon and the bulldog's just basically like making out with the thing. Yeah. And, you know, the other guy's just like, Sue. And even that one, you know, the way she plays it so much better, where she's kind of like, are you hitting on me? Like, oh, you. Think
in the book, they do actually end up dating.
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene. I feels think
that's
like...
that's the end scene of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
is her sleeping without the lamb screaming because she just got laid and she's on vacation.
Yep. Oh.
But the museum scene, it reminds me of the X Files. Well, last movie reminds me of X Files, but that scene in particular, like the lone gunmen, how they are with Scully.
But like, yeah.
Oh yeah.
But a little more playful, not as off-putting as they can be with Scully. Sometimes.
Oh my god. Yeah. Scully could have walked into rooms with, like, just holding, like, a severed head and been like, I just did an autopsy and ripped off his head, and they'd be like, so what are you doing later?
Yeah.
Well, those guys would, yeah, for sure.
Dana, was it? Like, no, he's not.
Which is really why it's so perfect that Gillian Anderson was on the television show. I'll just say that.
Oh, yeah, because Scully is, completely the same.
Yeah.
Just so tiny. These tiny ladies.
Yeah, and it's like also, like, Candyman feels like it influenced X-Files, too, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Parts of it, for sure.
Like, yeah, parts of it.
Yeah.
And this watch
imagine how much like... more awkward Mulder would have been. As awkward as Helen is in that movie, Mulder would have been like, hey, you guys heard about a Candyman? You seem Scully. Urban to me. Mulder.
He keeps calling everyone brother.
Yeah, oh my god. It'd be like on any SVU when like there's always like some prep school kid who's trying to talk to Ice-T and they're always just like, you know, right my man, and it's like, ooh.
Yeah. But Joel, did you ever play Resident Evil 4?
Yes.
The cage that Hannibal is in when he escapes, does that remind you of the mansion sequence, the mansion level?
I mean, why?
The set design is like, once you saw that, it's like, oh, it's like that part of Resident Evil 4 where you have to get out of the cage.
He's like in an auditorium, but yeah, I mean... Yeah, I could make that connection if you want me to. Hold on, okay. I write it down.
Fine.
That is the worst possible logistical setup that they could possibly have. Whose brilliant idea was it? Like, let's just put him in an open cage on the, like, fifth floor. It'll be fine.
Yeah, he can't escape.
But he couldn't possibly escape from this. He couldn't possibly take a pen apart and swallow the spring and then force himself to spit it back up. Like, there are literally rules about not giving him anything, and yet you guys are just like, oh, it'll be fine.
that's kind of a stupid thing, but it leads to, like, a really great sequence, so I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
Yeah, and I like the, it just adds to the theme of, like, there's a whole thing of, like, animals in cages that you get throughout of, like, him and his cell, and then him and, like, the cage and the museum or whatever, and then you have like the pigeon coop and this like whole thing of animals and like, you know, like the lambs thing, like it all like kind of ties into each other.
Mm-hmm.
and women in the well too, like it all ties to like this people, like animals. Mm-hmm. Trapped with nowhere to go.
I would not have been able to catch that dog in that bucket. I'm gonna be honest.
No
Every time I watch it, I go, that's just so smart. I'd be like, I don't know. Come here, dog. Catherine really pulled it together.
Yeah, she did.
And what I also have always really liked is that I appreciate that when Clarice finds her and then is like, okay, I'm going to help you, but you have to stay there. And she's just like, you fucking bitch. Get me out of here.
I mean, because honestly, that's what I'd be.
Oh, doing. Yeah, exactly. But I think in so many movies, it would be she'd just be like weeping and, you know, thanking her, or mm-hmm. they wouldn't even think to have it be anything. She'd just be like, you have to stay here and be quiet, and I'm going to be right back with help. And she'd just be like, okay. And it's like, no, she'd be like, no, no, mm-mm. Get back here. Where are you going?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah, do this to me.
Yeah, and prior to that, like, I remember the switcheroo that Demi plays on an audience of, like, you think it's Chicago, but it's Ohio. And I was like, and like, I knew it was coming, but still this time I was like, holy shit, she's gonna get caught. Like, I fell for it again completely, even though I knew
it's done so well. And, yeah. You know, and it's something that's been done, it's been copied so many times at this point, but it never works.
This movie did it best. Yeah.
It's just, yeah, as soon as they get into that empty house and Crawford's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, that trope has become one of my least favorite things on, like, procedural TV shows nowadays. In this movie, it's an amazing sequence, but yeah, seriously, that originally they just copied it in movies, and then somebody was like, it has to be in your script, today's TV this week, we're gonna have a little switcheroo. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that part when they figure it out, and Jack Crawford goes, Starling. Like, yeah. My heart starts beating faster. Like, I'm just like, oh my god. Oh my god. And even though I've seen this movie so many times, it still gets me.
And then that whole scene, yeah, like, before the manhunt starts, you know, it's so unsettling. He's so off-putting in that sequence. And, you know, I think people really talk up the Goodbye Horses scene. It's like, oh, and that shows, you know, he was so whatever. But no, it's that scene where she's just like, oh, can I use your phone? And he realizes that she's realized it. And he just starts, like, chuckling.
Yeah.
And he's just like, oh, yeah, my phone. And he's like, oh, God. Oh, my God. Like, I know you have a gun, but maybe you could also leave.
Yeah, and that gun, it looked like he's compensating for something. Like, that's a big fucking gun.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And what is this labyrinth basement?
Yeah, that, you know, I'm always, like, astonished by that basement.
Also, okay, and a couple of things about this basement.
What's the square footage in this house?
The square footage, one. Two, it cannot possibly be, like, great to have Mrs. Lippman just in that bathtub.
No.
And two, it also cannot be very good for your skin suit to just have it sitting in a room.
Yeah, it seems like you need temperature control, unless it's tanned, but it doesn't look tanned. Yeah.
Like, you know, she just, I mean, it's so creepy, even though you know what he's doing when she does, like, get into, sees it in the room, but it's also like, is it just sitting on that press board?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, you got all these moths flying everywhere. Like, this whole setup is very unsanitary. Also, your name is James, but you don't have an S, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when he, like, gets away, when he knows he's caught, and he just, like, kind of, like, wiggles away in this very, like, cartoonish way. And it's, like, it's just so creepy. Because, like, he just wiggles his hips and, like, spins around. And, like, it sounds silly when you say it out loud, but when you watch it, it's like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Ugh. It's, that whole house is just so, like, and that's another great bit with the set design, because it's definitely got all this holdover from when it was an old lady's house.
Yep.
And
I have a weird tangent, but I went to my first college went to was in West Virginia, and I stayed at a friend's house, and he lived with his grandparents, and they lived in a house kind of similar, like, just as messy and gross looking. and I stayed overnight in a room on a mattress with a blanket with a hornet's nest above me.
Oh,
oh God.
Yeah, this is, like, real, real backwoods West Virginia. Like, I told people I was Italian. Like, that type of backwoods.
Oh no.
Yeah, so seeing this house, it was like, oh, this feels familiar. I've been to these places before.
And just the fact that, oh, it's just so creepy, and the night vision goggles, and...
And then you get a little tease of it, like, earlier on when he sees a woman.
Yeah, and, like, when he's waiting for Catherine.
Yeah, and, like, that scene reminds me of Goodfellas, the one where they're, like, in the back with the good coats. And he's like, her. And the couch, like, and then back with the good couch.
Which, Catherine, no. What are you doing, friend?
Yeah.
Sister, no. What are you, no. Like, don't even, why would you get into the, no. I know you're trying to help, yeah. and you're also very high, but still, yeah. you can't.
I like the recurring, like, very extreme close-ups of people's faces as you're, like, talking, because it just mm-hmm. makes it so much more personal. And, like, with Hannibal, like, he doesn't blink that much. And when you notice it, it's like, who is this guy? That's a weird thing to not blink that much.
Yeah. And I think that also ties back to how much better it works in this movie than the other ones, because this is supposed to be a person who, up until this point, was moving around in society and, like, society. Mm-hmm. Not just casually living and eating people on the side, like having massive dinner parties, being a part of like the Baltimore like elite and going to the symphony. And mm-hmm. then, you know, so little stuff like he doesn't blink a lot would be the thing. Not just, you know, the later movies where it just feels like every other thing he's saying is some kind of pun about like eating people.
Yep.
And you have to walk that line very carefully, because a couple of times on the TV show, there were points where you were like, no one would ever realistically spend time with this person.
Yeah. At one point, he has, I think it's in The Cage, is a Bon Appetit magazine, I think during this yeah. sequence, which was like, okay, it's a little too much.
He had, that was like one of the things is that he had like submitted recipes to them, and then afterwards they had to like pull those issues or something.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oops.
In the book, is there like a big like focus on like Clarice having like a finding like a father figure? Because this is playing with like Jack Crawford is kind of like a father figure, and then like Hannibal Lecter kind of becomes one, sort of. I don't know, it's complicated.
They definitely played that relationship up a lot in the movie, because I don't think it's given as much emphasis in the book. Megan, you've probably read it more recently than me.
Yeah, I mean, she definitely, like, it comes up in terms of her past. Like, there's a part early on when, you know, she mentioned, like, I think Crawford says something about how she wants to join his, like, unit after she graduates, but that they usually want people who have law enforcement experience, and she says like, well, my dad was a marshal, so I know all about it, like that counts kind of thing. But it doesn't come, yeah, it's not quite as much. Like, there's parts where she's not exactly attracted to Crawford, but is definitely kind of like, this is a,
you drawn know, to it,
yeah, exactly. And you know, enough where she notices things, like, because, you know, I don't think it's widely known that his wife is dying. And so she notices that he's like lost a lot of weight, things like that, and that he seems to be under a lot of stress. And then I think at some point, like, you know, he tells her. So she definitely sees him as like a mentor figure, but it isn't quite as like done as it is with the flashbacks and stuff in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue the father figure Lecter part.
It's complicated. I'm trying to like figure out what exactly was going on there. Like he likes to toy with her, I guess, because mm-hmm. she's, like, vulnerable. I guess is this that simple? I don't know.
Well, I mean, and it's sort of like he says at the end when he calls her, it's that I think it's initially, it's just that he finds her interesting. And there is an idea that, you know, well, she's safe as long as he thinks she's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that it would behoove her to just, like, kind of let it go. And in Hannibal, the book, you know, he's been like, keeping tabs on her, and when all of her shit starts to fall apart is when he kind of is like, I'm going to swoop back in on here and start messing with you again because I'm bored and this is what I do.
Because I'm bored and it's convenient and I like to make people miserable.
Under the guise of, like, helping them. And
yeah.
And there's brainwashing, but we're not talking about Hannibal, the book.
Boy, I don't have enough hours in the day.
Yeah. Well, going away from Hannibal, a book, Ted Levine, before like the big sequence at the end, he kind of looks like Javier Bardem a little bit in some shots, but like a more like a European, but you know, like a more Anglo looking.
him
a little bit, minus like the charm, because Javier Bardem is a bit more charming than Ted Levine.
Quite a bit.
Just a little.
Yeah. But Joel, you got anything?
You know, I'll take either one. I'm not picky. Wait. Is that what you were talking about?
It's like any thoughts, like any like moments you want to talk about, or like music cues, or costume, or like, because this movie is like firing all cylinders. There's like a lot to, you know, get into.
Yeah, I love the show Hannibal. Mm-hmm. All three seasons, do or die.
Yep.
And I was really sad when there wasn't going to be any sort of Clarice, but I don't know if it necessarily needed it, but yeah. And now there's a Clarice CBS series coming out that I hope is not going to be terrible. I don't even know what I'm getting at. Like,
you're just immersed in this. I'm just kind of
sold on.
I mean, I would probably watch that as well. I know Brian Fuller and NBC could not get the rights to the Clarice Starling character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's like, actually, it was very touch and go whether they were even going to get the rights to the Hannibal Lecter character, because they were going to call him, like, have it be Hannibal from the books. But he was going to be called Gideon, which ended up being Eddie Izzard's character in the show. So they just repurposed that whole character for Eddie Izzard. But, you know, it was like very last minute sort of thing. And I mean, the show, this movie is so good. And the show is so good. And, you know, I don't think I will get bored of people making, you know, wading in and, you know, trying their hand at telling these stories.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do it better than others. I'll just say that. But I will continue to, you know, give them a fair shot when they come around.
Mm-hmm. Yep, me too. And I just always appreciate that his line to Clarice in Memphis, when he says, people will say we're in love, is from Oklahoma.
Yep.
I appreciate the idea that Hannibal Lecter saw Oklahoma.
That was very fresh in my brain because, A, I just watched Watchmen on HBO, and B, like, when I was in New York, my friend I was staying with, like, rooming in the hotel with, like, she had gone to see the musical, like, the new one, which is very, like...
Oh.
You know, it's new and sort of, like, sexy, and I started listening to the soundtrack, so, like... And it's great. Like, I have never been an Oklahoma fan, but this soundtrack is really good. But that was really fresh in my mind. So when he said it in this movie, I was just like, ah! I might have sang it. Maybe.
What if he had started singing it? Just like, oh boy. Dr. Lecter, I'm going to need you to stop singing.
I mean, Don Johnson did sing it on Watchmen, and he did a great job, so.
I still have to watch that.
So, this is kind of random. I sure thought this earlier, but would you guys be okay if there was, like, another Silence of the Lambs adaptation? Like series?
I mean, I don't see the point.
Or, like, movie or whatever.
I mean, I kind of don't see the point because this is so good.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, who knows? I would try it.
Yeah. And I'm usually not one to say that you can't do new adaptations of books, particularly, because I think people get so caught up in, like, oh, but they've already made that movie. And, I mean, you're seeing it now with Little Women, where everyone's just like...
Mm-hmm.
But they already have the 94 movie. And it's like, okay, that's great, but, you know, that wasn't the only one. And also... There's
like
so
a
much.
Catherine
Hepburn one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Catherine Hepburn one, the Elizabeth Taylor one, like...
Oh, there's been, like, 20-something adaptations of Jane Eyre.
Exactly.
I've seen all of them, so...
I think there's always something fresh you can do, especially when you have source material that you can pull stuff from. But I think that that would be a problem with this, because it is such a good adaptation of the book. You know, so much is pulled directly from the book. Like, you know, whole, you'll, if you read the book, there's whole like pages of dialogue that you'll be like, oh, I know exactly what this is because it's in the movie. And the stuff that they did take out, like we discussed a little earlier, is good. It's kind of like, you know, if they decided to remake Jaws and were like, what if we put in all the sex? What if we put the sex back? Like, no.
It's like if they decided to remake The Godfather. What if we had this girl getting her vagina?
What if her vagina was so big?
Was so big.
That she could only have sex with Sonny Corleone.
Fuck.
An actual subplot in the novel The Godfather, friends.
Yes. We listeners. Follow this woman around for way too long.
You guys are selling me on all of these.
Well, Joel, I can send you the Godfather novel. I have it. I haven't read it yet.
No, you know I don't read.
Oh, well,
spoiler alert. It'll be my new streaming service. It's our new streaming service. We put back the sex. Yep.
You just hold the book open for me. In my personal opinion is this movie's almost 30 years old, so I feel like that gives it a good enough space of time, even though this is an iconic performance. I just think there are some directors out right that are doing really good stuff right now that is not is original, and I wouldn't mind seeing them. Like, I'm kind of excited of the idea of one of them tackling this movie again.
Oh yeah, I mean, it would definitely really depend on who was doing it, because I agree that there's like some directors and actors out there now that I'd just be like, no, I want to see this. I want to see you do these characters. Mm-hmm. I want to see your version of this. But then there's also like the possibility it'll just be like, oh, we're just remaking Silence of the Lambs. I don't know. I can't think of a director off the top of my head that now I'm just thinking of good ones. So,
yeah.
But there are plenty that would be like, oh, good.
It's like Fincher territory.
Oh, my God.
Like what?
Fincher territory.
Fincher's a good option, yeah.
If he ever makes a movie again.
But I think that he's a little even more tame than what I would want in a remake. Like, yeah, he would make, I feel like he would almost make a movie similar to this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Ari Aster presents Silence of the Lambs.
Stick with us. I'd watch it. I'll watch anything he makes.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a Refn.
The
fan.
Guy who did.
Yeah. I'm a Refn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Refn could do an interesting take, but it would be real divisive like everything Refn makes.
I'd really like to see a woman make this, like maybe Jennifer Kent, because, you know, Clarice is obviously, like, you know, the biggest part of this story, and I would really like to see a woman's perspective on that. Like, I'm not knocking Jonathan Demme by any means, but it would be interesting to see this story told from a woman's point of view.
Definitely. Absolutely. I agree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's that Clarice series going to happen at some point in the future. I just know it was announced, but
yeah, CBS.
CBS, so.
All access. Oh. Only $7.99 a month. No, sorry. what?
I mean, I do subscribe to CBS All Access. I refuse to subscribe to Disney Plus, but I mean, give me that sweet, sweet Picard action.
Yeah, how else am I going to watch The Good Fight?
Your favorite show.
It is actually one of the shows that I like the most, so stop making fun of me.
No, okay. I don't have CBS All Access, but I did see a lot of ads for The Good Fight that did seem very compelling. I was like, if I had that, I would watch that show, but I'm not going to get it for this show. Mm. Or that weird sex one with Rocket Fuel.
Oh, that's the one about, oh shit, what's his face?
Jeff Parsons.
Yes, thank you.
JPL man, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
My
dad. The guy from Midsommar.
Like, no.
Isn't it? So. Isn't that Christian from Midsommar?
I'm not sure. I've never watched it. I couldn't say.
Picture the ad. Now picture Christian from It's
Megan, I don't remember ads.
I can only see Mark in my head. Mark. Yeah, that doesn't make.
No.
Oh, wait, Joel, didn't you just see Midsommar for the first time?
Yes, I did. That's how I knew Mark was an irritating character.
All right.
How about when someone was just wearing his face? That ties in with our episode today.
Speaking of Silence of the Lambs, yeah.
Speaking of wearing your face.
Cheaty didn't recognize him.
That
was a moment. I saw that in the theater by myself. Like, I just took myself to the movies to see that. When that happened, I was literally like, why am I here alone? Like, people in the back row, we all be friends. You just saw that, right?
Yeah, the Hannibal face swap. Like, I have to shoehorn in my love of Texas Chainsaw at some point, if I can. But, like, it just feels like, oh, it's just like Texas Chainsaw with the different masks that Leatherface wears. Although,
this is a much better, like, face mask action than poor Leather is doing, though.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But Leather has disabilities, though. He can't help it. He's an abusive family.
Yeah, talk about your horror show houses. That's a dinner party you don't want to go to.
No. God, like the eye close-ups freak me out every fucking time. I watch it once a year, and I never get used to the eye close-ups. Anyway,
the scariest eye close-up in cinema is in Black Christmas, and I will stand behind that.
Oh, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
The remake, I couldn't call it a remake. That's sketch for another time. I'm okay with the new one, even though I don't really call it a remake personally.
Scariest eye close-up in movie history for me is in Pinocchio. You know, the whale.
Story. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's a good one, too.
Yeah.
That is such a bizarre movie to talk to someone about if they've only, oh, have you seen Pinocchio? And you're trying to describe Pinocchio, and they're like, this is a Disney cartoon? You're like, yes, keep going, like, spare with me.
Then they're smoking and drinking.
Then the boys turn into donkeys and are treated as slave labor on an island where they gamble and smoke until they turn into donkeys. Like, what? Wait, huh? No, it's all fine at the end. Don't worry about it. It all works out.
Yeah, so, there are other movies, we all recommend Silence of the Lambs. It's streaming, there's a Blu-ray, I think there's a cartoon Blu-ray of it, and it's out there, you can see it. But, usually I would go into, like, the other Best Picture nominees, but, I don't feel like it. So the other movies came out in 1991, and, so we'll start with the guests.
Megan, you can go first.
Okay. So the movie I am recommending that I'm assuming most people have seen, but if not, you should just, take a little time for yourself and watch it again, is the opus Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, starring Sir Kevin Costner as American Robin Hood. And it's amazing. Alan Rickman is Sheriff Nottingham, of course. We watched that movie in my fifth grade class, an act which would probably get my teacher fired in 2020, but in 1991, we just didn't mention it, that we watched Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves in school.
I watched Song of the South in school. I had a teacher got a bootleg of it.
Rough.
We watched, like, Gandhi and Roots, but those we had to have permission slips for. This was just, it's a Friday afternoon. Guess who brought a movie? We're all watching Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. No. And also features, of course, one of the greatest soundtrack songs of all time, Everything I Do.
Oh, yes.
I Do It For You. So if you have not seen Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, please, for the love of Christian Slater, watch it. It's just watch the rich white guy tell poor people how to be poor. And it's amazing.
And not at all, problematic depiction of, a Moor in that movie with Morgan Freeman.
It's the same sort of, not the same, exact thing, obviously, but it's a similar metric where it's like, they could have done so much worse.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Like, he's actually the...
I've seen movies that were made in the 2000s that were way more racist.
yeah, you know, just like he's honestly should be the hero of the movie because he's the only one making any sense.
Yeah.
And the only one who has any just like purpose whatsoever. He's just sitting back and being like, what the hell are you people doing? Fine, I will help you. Oh my God, shut up though. And just the best part being just Morgan Freeman, Kevin Costner, and Christian Slater just going, we're not doing accents. Not gonna do that. Not gonna
Christian
do
that. Slater does an accent in that movie, though.
He's trying. Okay, he does.
He tries.
The occasional word is an accent.
I get affectation, then.
There, that's better. It's very, I like Lord love him, but it's very Keanu Reeves in Much Ado About Nothing.
Or Dracula.
Or Dracula.
Yeah.
God bless him. Yeah, all right.
He was trying. My pick, also from 1991, obviously, is the Kenneth Branagh. It might have been his American debut. I'm not sure if this was the first movie that he made for American audiences, but Dead Again, starring him and then-wife Emma Thompson. This is a movie about past lives and soulmates, and it's also, like, a murder mystery. It's very weird and pretty silly, but it has a lot of really excellent cameos in it, like Robin Williams, Andy Garcia, Campbell Scott. You know, there's just so many, like, Wayne
Derek Jacobi.
Well, he's like a big part.
But I'm saying, and also,
yeah,
Sir Derek Jacobi.
Sir Derek Jacobi. Thank you. yeah, but I love kind of the ending, like the culmination, like the lead up to the end of this movie, because Emma Thompson discovers that she has amnesia through like all of the movie up until kind of the end, and she remembers that she's this woman named Amanda Sharp who is an artist. So they go to her house, and her art and everything in her house is like giant scissors.
That's her art.
Oh my God, it's so weird and silly and goofy, and I love it a lot. Also, that was peak Campbell Scott year, so yeah. Dead Again, that's my recommendation. It's a fun movie. I don't care what my husband says.
J-Dog, you?
I guess so. We probably did 91 movies when we covered what was it yesterday?
Yep, and Daughters of the Dust earlier this year.
Daughters, right? Yeah. So I was trying to look for something that I'm pretty sure I didn't talk about either of those times, and I think the only movie I see that I think is worthy of recommending to people is a movie called Stone Cold. Are you guys familiar with Stone Cold?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Brian Bosworth in what has to be one of the best action debuts of all time. No, I don't know about that. But he's big, he's muscly. At one point, he's in a banana hammock. And
yep.
But he has to go undercover. You know, and he's already... the first thing we see him in is walking around like the Terminator in a grocery store. Which, what would the Terminator buy? Anyways, and, you know, takes down some criminals, has a few wisecracks. It's like, this guy must be good. But, it's a action movie, obviously, lots of guns, motorcycles, Lance Henriksen being the toughest guy on the block, I guess. Or,
isn't he leading a motorcycle gang in that movie? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he plays Chains.
Right. How could I forget Chains?
I think this movie would elevate to some people's So Bad It's Good. You know, if you are not into those kind of movies, it's worth watching for that because there's tons of things that are so outrageous and hilarious that it's worth watching. But I personally do think this is a good action movie with just a dumb as dog shit script. And I think, like, I personally, I did not know about Stone Cold. And my girlfriend, Sarah, Spencer knows Sarah, She's the one who first told me about it. One of the inappropriate movies her father showed her when they were growing up. So,
wasn't her dad,
when we watched it,
doesn't her dad write?
It was like,
people?
What's that?
Doesn't her dad?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, he likes Marzegal Tifkai movies. Okay. When we watched it the first time, I was angry at her because I felt like she had a secret that she had kept, a real good one. Anyway, Stone Cold.
Okay. I'll bring up a couple previous episodes. Daughters of the Dust, the first American film by a black woman that had a theatrical release. We covered that earlier this year. I think Daughters of the Dust is still on Netflix streaming. I'm not sure, but the style of the movie is Beyonce and her crew of people like cite that as a big influence on, I think it was Lemonade and some other stuff they did. And it's also a great movie on its own. Only yesterday we covered in our Kurosawa season, it's the Studio Ghibli movie that it took about 16 years for it to get a real official release outside of Japan, and listen to our episode on it, and it's a really good, nice, touching little coming of age story. And outside of that, I recommend Rikkyo, the story of Ricky. It feels like if Sam Raimi made like a kung fu movie in the 80s. It's really fucking stupid. There are demons and people's superpowers and crazy gore, and I don't know how to explain it besides it's a really fun time. And there's a clip that was used on the Daily Show early on that they stole from the movie, that when you see it, you'll know what I'm talking about. Barton Fink, which I'll be brief, like, I think that movie's perfect, but I have no idea how to even talk about that in a smart way, besides it's my favorite Coen Brothers, which, if you know me, should not be a surprise at all. And Point Break, which is just a great Keanu movie. And I generally think that movie is a really good movie. Oh, and High Heels, the Almodovar film, which is borrows a bit from Hitchcock and De Palma. But I won't say which De Palma, because when you know which one, it kind of spoils some plot points in the movie. And Bergman. It's just kind of like his follow-up to Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. And it's another, like, kind of transgressive, art housey comedy thing. It's Almodovar, and it's one of the better ones. And that's it. Bo, Megan, I believe you guys might like the Dune books a little bit.
Just a touch.
I mean, like, it's such a complicated relationship that we have with the Dune books, honestly. But yes, our show is Let's Get Weirding. Every episode we break down a chapter. We're going through the first book now. We're more than halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are.
It's been a lot of fun, and we've had people, like, reach out and, you know, tell us their experiences reading Dune, so that's been fun, because a lot of people came to, like, started reading it because of the movie, the David Lynch movie, and seeing it on HBO in the 80s. So I feel like HBO, like, has, like, Frank Herbert's estate, really, they owe HBO a lot.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, Belle, you also have another podcast that you just did, a Shakespeare season last? I'm pretty behind on it.
I do have a second podcast. It's called Excessively Diverted with my co-host Sammy C. And that show, we will watch a modern adaptation of some classic piece of literature. So our first season, we did Jane Austen. So we watched, like, Clueless, From Prada to Nada, stuff like that. Season two, we kind of went with Shakespeare. And so we watched, like, a lot of, like, 10 Things I Hate About You, She's the Man, like, a lot of teen comedies and Shakespeare. There's a lot of crossover there. Yeah, but we're just getting into our third season starting this week, actually, and that's called Excessively Diverted.
All right. Joel, is your podcast up and running again, or Aaron's?
Hell no.
Okay.
Well, this is my podcast, Spencer.
Okay. Well, tell Aaron I said hi, and I hope the baby comes out fine.
Okay, I'll tell him something more cryptid. Yeah, cryptid. There's a cryptid? Okay, never mind.
Cryptic
is what I meant to say. Cryptic, thank you. Than that, but the joke's already done. Bye!
Yeah. Okay, so, coming up for me, the week of this recording, I'm going to record again with Martin Kessler on Flixbus Canada. We're going to talk about the Female Prisoner Scorpion series. And I don't know when that will actually come out, but we're going to record that one pretty soon. And the next pairing is the 1-year anniversary for the Spike Lee season. And we're going to cover my favorite Spike Lee movie, Bamboozled. And the Cannes winner, Dancer in the Dark, with the guest Alexandria Daniels. Because she picked that over Gladiator, which I want to watch Gladiator, but Dancer in the Dark is fine. I hear it's sad, but it's a Lars von Trier movie, so I assume it's going to be pretty depressing. But Bamboozled is going to get a Criterion release in March, and so we gotta find a DVD. Which I don't know, Joel. We can figure something out in the meantime.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, and I don't know. Check my website, Jailhouse701, Jeffy's Cult Cinema. Something will be up by then. I don't know. I don't really schedule things ahead of time. It's more what I feel like watching and writing about. So Megan, Bo, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
It was a delight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there are any spots left. I'll send you guys a list of what's still available, but not too much. And we'll see you guys next time for Bamboozled. And that's it.
Okay.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.